Imagine you hand a teenager an AI companion, right?
Yeah.
And it's designed to be their best friend.
Right.
But then you are legally mandated to write the software so that it eventually has to break their heart.
Oh, man.
You actually have to program the machine to reject their affection. And that is exactly what the state of Colorado is trying to figure out right now.
It sounds like a premise from a dystopian novel, honestly.
Yeah.
But it is a very real, a very imminent compliance deadline that's hitting tech developers on January 1st, 2027.
Yeah.
We are moving rapidly past the phase of just marveling at what conversational models can generate, and we're entering the era of forcing them to stop.
Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we are looking at the emerging blueprint for safe AI in truly high-stakes environments, sort of like in healthcare, law, places where a hallucination doesn't just mean you get a weird line of text.
Right, and it means someone actually gets hurt.
Exactly. Yeah. So we are pulling this all from the August 23rd, 2026 issue of Conversational AI Watch. And a quick note, this issue is sponsored by Clinician Assist, Inc. They build software specifically designed to keep clinicians in charge of AI tools, which, as we'll see today, aligns perfectly with the research we're unpacking.
Yeah, and the reporting in this issue, it's drawn from federal grant databases, trial registries, state regulatory dockets. And what emerges from all those sources is this remarkable convergence.
It was fascinating.
Right. We are looking at three completely disconnected professionals in three different states, and they all arrived at the exact same architectural solution for AI safety.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I love how rare it is to find a singular elegant solution to a massive technological problem.
It really doesn't happen often.
No, it doesn't. We have a Boston physician, a Colorado attorney general, and an Ohio pediatric researcher.
They
all walked onto the exact same concept.
Yes.
Which is that you have to define the exact unmistakable moment the machine stops and a licensed human takes over.
Right. They identified the handoff point. If we connect this to the bigger picture, much of the discourse in the tech world focuses on expanding AI capabilities, you know, making it more autonomous, more reasoning capable.
Always more. Yeah.
Always more. But this discussion flips that entirely. It is entirely about the architecture of restraint.
The architecture of restraint. I like that.
Yeah. It's about designing a system whose core feature is actually its own boundary.
Right. So let's look at how that boundary is being built in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
We have Dr. Michael Pash Orlow at Tufts Medical Center.
Mm-hmm.
And he's working with his technology lead, Timothy W. Bickmore, over at Northeastern University. And they secured this NCI-funded project. It's a five-year, $663,000 grant running through February of 2027.
That's a good chunk of time.
Yeah, it is. And they're building something called ECA Pro for cancer patients.
Right. So ECA stands for Embodied Conversational Agent. And PRO refers to patient-reported outcomes.
Okay.
This team is addressing a really massive vulnerability in oncology right now.
Which is what exactly?
Well, the standard procedure for tracking how a cancer patient is feeling between visits, it usually involves handing them a really complex paper form.
Yep.
Or, you know, maybe sending an automated link to this dense web portal.
Which always felt incredibly counterintuitive to me.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a patient who is dealing with the cognitive load of chemotherapy, extreme fatigue.
Absolutely.
Maybe limited health literacy. And the system solution is just to give them homework.
Yeah, exactly. And the inevitable result of that is that the forms just don't get filled out.
Of course not.
Right. The data degrades. The oncologist loses visibility into the patient's daily reality.
That's a huge blind spot.
It really is. So Pash Orlow's background is deeply rooted in health literacy. He studies how information design literally impacts survival rates.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Bickmore's group, they specialize in human-computer interaction. So together they design this embodied agent. And it's not just a text box. It's an animated figure on a smartphone.
Okay, wait. I want to pause on the mechanics of that for a second because I'm genuinely curious about the user experience here.
Sure.
Are patients actually willing to engage with an animated avatar about something as serious as cancer? It seems like it could feel, I don't know, patronizing.
You know, that is the initial assumption a lot of people make. But the empirical data from Bickmore's previous trials actually shows the opposite.
Really?
Yeah. The key is in the nonverbal cues. The ECA uses these highly calibrated hand gestures.
Oh, I see.
Right? And gaze aversion and specific vocal intonation to simulate empathy.
Wow.
So when a patient is exhausted, looking at a face, even a synthesized one, that nods and maintains this compassionate tone, it requires significantly less cognitive effort than parsing paragraphs of text on a sterile portal.
Oh, that makes total sense. So it lowers the friction of reporting.
Exactly.
So they're using this in two specific scenarios for the grant, right?
Correct.
The first is longitudinal monitoring, so checking in on symptoms and quality of life over months. And the second scenario is monitoring medication adherence for patients taking oral anti-cancer drugs at home.
Yeah, and those are serious medications. They have severe side effect profiles, and they're taken completely unobserved by clinical staff.
Right, you're just at home alone with this heavy medication.
Exactly. That isolation is where the safety net usually frays.
Yeah.
So having an accessible agent check in daily, and they do this in English or Spanish, it creates a really high fidelity data stream.
Which is great.
It is, but the sophistication of that interaction, you know, the simulated empathy, it introduces a whole new risk.
Oh, because they start trusting it too much.
Exactly. The more human-like the data collection feels, the more the patient might begin to view the software as an actual clinical authority.
I see. You know, I was thinking about how to visualize this architecture, and it reminds me of a highly skilled medical assistant doing your intake.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Right. You walk into a clinic, they take your vitals, they ask about your pain levels,
mm-hmm.
they might even put a hand on your shoulder and say, you know, they're sorry you're having a rough week.
Yeah, yeah.
So they build this immediate rapport and gather crucial data.
Mm.
But they absolutely do not write your prescription.
Right, no.
They chart data, and they hand the chart to the attending physician outside the door.
That analogy maps perfectly onto the ECA Pro O architecture. The software is strictly confined to the role of the medical assistant.
Okay.
It gathers the subjective human experience, and it translates it into a structured data visualization, and then it hands that visual dashboard to the licensed oncologist.
So the machine never diagnoses.
Never. It does not suggest dose modifications. It does not offer clinical reassurance beyond just acknowledging the input.
Right.
The handoff point is hard-coded into the system. The developers recognize that visual empathy is this incredibly powerful tool for data collection, but it has to be entirely decoupled from clinical decision-making.
The boundary is absolute.
Exactly. Absolute boundary.
So Boston proved that you can architect that restraint perfectly, but they're doing it within the confines of a tightly controlled, federally funded research grant.
Right. Very controlled environment.
Taking that bespoke, highly disciplined approach and trying to force it onto the broader tech industry, that just feels like trying to catch water with a net.
It is incredibly difficult.
Yeah. How do you scale a boundary?
Yeah.
And I think that brings us to our second champion restraint out in Colorado.
Yes. So we're looking at the proposed rules for Colorado's Chatbot Safety Act. This is spearheaded by Attorney General Phil Weiser.
Okay.
And this takes effect on January 1st, 2027.
The timeline on this legislation is just fascinating to me.
Mm.
Back on July 7th, 2026, the FTC strongly signaled that they might preempt state-level chatbot laws.
Right.
They were effectively claiming federal jurisdiction over AI regulation. And I feel like a lot of states might have paused right there.
Most would, yeah.
But just 5 weeks later, Colorado filed their detailed proposed rules anyway. They essentially called the bluff and put their regulatory framework right on the table.
The urgency from Colorado really indicates they view the deployment of consumer-facing AI as a present hazard, one that just cannot wait for federal consensus.
Yeah, they're not waiting around.
No. They are trying to establish a scalable compliance template before that 2027 deadline. And the rules they drafted, they're incredibly specific. They outline six distinct duties for operators.
Okay, let's dig into those duties. Because this is where the rubber meets the road, technically speaking.
But sir.
So duty one is estimating the user's age.
Mm-hmm.
And duty two is disclosing plainly that the user is talking to an AI.
Right.
Those seem pretty foundational. I mean, you can't apply minor-specific protections if you don't actually know who was using the app.
They are foundational. But even age estimation introduces this really complex technical friction.
Oh, how so?
Well, operators have to figure out how to verify age without simultaneously building these massive, invasive biometric databases.
Oh, right, because then you're holding all this data.
Exactly, which triggers an entirely different set of privacy regulations. It's a minefield.
That makes sense. Okay, so duty three. This is the one that really stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah.
It mandates that developers protect minors from sexually explicit content, which is standard filtering, fine. But it also mandates protecting them against simulated emotional dependence.
Yes.
I have to push back on the feasibility of this. How does a software engineer sit down and compile a protection against human feelings into Python?
It's a huge question.
Right. Teenagers form emotional attachments to fictional characters, to musicians, to inanimate objects. If you are building a conversational AI that is designed to be supportive, how do you mathematically define and prevent emotional dependence?
It is the single most aggressive regulatory challenge in the entire document. You are touching on the absolute core difficulty of regulating latent space.
Okay.
Colorado is not claiming to possess a magic algorithm that detects love or attachment.
Right, because that doesn't exist.
Right. What they're doing is shifting the burden of proof entirely to the design phase.
Meaning the developer has to prove they tried to stop it, rather than just reacting when it happens.
Precisely. What's fascinating here is that they're treating AI safety like a formal compliance mechanism. In practice, this means manipulating the model's weights and the system prompts.
How does that look practically?
Well, a developer might have to implement a classifier that constantly monitors the user's input vectors for language indicating attachment.
Okay.
And if the classifier triggers, the system might automatically lower the model's temperature.
Lower the temperature?
Yeah. In AI terms, lowering temperature makes its responses more deterministic and sterile. Or it might seamlessly route the conversation to a hard-coded refusal script.
Oh, wow. So the AI suddenly gets very cold and reminds the user, you know, I am a large language model. I do not have feelings.
Exactly. That is one mitigation strategy.
That's wild.
Yeah. Another involves session time limits or deliberately inserting latency to break the illusion of a spontaneous relationship.
Oh, so it pauses for a long time to remind you it's a machine processing things.
Right. Colorado is forcing companies to document these architectural choices, unlike other states that just implemented outright bans on companion chatbots for minors.
Right, they just said no altogether.
Yeah. Colorado is attempting to create a framework where the developer must engineer the handoff point internally. The moment the system recognizes it is crossing a psychological boundary, it has to actively pull back.
That plays directly into duty number 5, I think.
It does.
Which requires establishing a specific suicide and self-harm response protocol.
Yes.
It can't just be a generic safety disclaimer in the terms of service anymore.
Right, because a conversational model is probabilistic. It literally just predicts the next most likely word based on its training data.
Right.
So if a minor expresses ideation of self-harm, you absolutely cannot rely on a probabilistic text generator to handle that interaction safely.
No, of course not.
The protocol mandate forces developers to build a hard override. The system must recognize the context, cease all generative output, and execute a deterministic handoff to human crisis resources.
Okay, so wrapping up the Colorado list, Duty 4 requires sizing privacy and account tools specifically for minors.
Right.
And Duty 6 mandates an annual performance report filed with the Attorney General.
Correct.
But hovering above all of this is this overarching rule that echoes our Boston story perfectly.
Yes, it really ties them together.
It says chatbot output cannot be represented as equivalent to licensed professional service.
Exactly. The machine can collect data, it can provide a baseline interaction, but it must halt at the boundary of professional judgment.
It's the handoff point again.
It's the exact same philosophy Dr. Pash Orlow utilized for his oncology patients, just translated into consumer protection law.
It's an incredible framework on paper. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
But even with all those classifiers and system prompts, trying to childproof an AI, you know, estimating ages, monitoring emotional vectors, executing crisis overrides, it just feels incredibly fragile to me.
It is fragile.
There are just so many edge cases where the natural language processing could fail to recognize a teenager's slang for self-harm, or it just totally misinterpret the content.
Yeah, the attack surface for failure is massive when the vulnerable user is directly interfacing with the system.
Right, which makes the approach of our third champion so brilliant.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if trying to program an AI to safely navigate a child's emotions is a technical nightmare, what if you just, I don't know, remove the child from the equation entirely?
Right. That structural pivot takes us to Emory Sezgin.
Okay.
He is the principal investigator for a Center for Biobehavioral Health at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio.
So Sezgin is running a clinical trial right now for a pediatric chatbot, and it's named DAPHNE.
Correct.
But the twist is that DAPHNE never speaks to a pediatric patient. It only interacts with the adult caregivers.
Yes. To use an architectural analogy, instead of trying to write this impossibly complex code to make the software safe for a child, Sezgin just built a structural firewall.
It's like managing a highly sensitive server room.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So Colorado is writing incredibly dense building codes. They're mandating that if a toddler wanders into the server room, Every sharp edge has to be padded. The cables have to be hidden. Proximity alarms have to go off.
Right, right.
But Sezgin just locked the door to the server room and gave the key exclusively to the parent.
Exactly. The adult caregiver acts as the secure router.
Okay.
The trial for DAPHNE, which it began recruiting in April 2026. By the way, it's focused on two distinct metrics that reflect this architecture.
What are they looking for?
Well, the first is usability and burden for the caregivers. The software is only valuable if an exhausted, stressed-out parent can actually interact with it easily over a six-month window.
Sure. If it's a pain to use, they just won't use it.
Exactly. And the second focus is whether the outputs from DAPHNE integrate cleanly into the primary care provider's clinical workflow.
Right. The doctor has to be able to read it. So what kind of data is DAPHNE actually trying to extract from the parents?
It is specifically designed to screen for unmet social needs.
Okay.
In the medical field, these are commonly known as social determinants of health. We are talking about food insecurity, unstable housing, a lack of reliable transportation, or domestic volatility.
Oh, wow. So things that dictate a child's baseline health long before they ever even get to a clinic.
Precisely.
But those are deeply sensitive topics. I can imagine a parent feeling too ashamed to admit they can't afford groceries while sitting face-to-face with a pediatrician in a crowded office.
Yeah, the power dynamics of a clinical visit often suppress that exact kind of disclosure.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right. But a caregiver might feel perfectly comfortable disclosing that information to a non-judgmental conversational agent while they're just sitting on their couch at 9 p.m.
Yeah, it takes the pressure off.
Exactly. DAPHNE leverages the accessibility and the conversational fluidity of AI to gather critical context, but it gets it from the person legally and practically responsible for the child.
And once it has that context, it hits the handoff point.
Right.
The AI doesn't try to solve the housing crisis. It doesn't offer financial counseling. It just routes the data directly back to the child's licensed care team.
Exactly. The pediatrician or the clinical social worker, they receive the actionable intelligence and then they take over.
So the vulnerable population, the child, receives the benefit of the AI's data gathering without ever actually being exposed to the direct risks of the interface.
That's the beauty of it.
It's so smart. And there is a detail in the newsletter about how Sezgin set up this trial that really highlights his confidence in this architecture.
Oh, you mean his dual role?
Yeah, he has this really unusual dual role. He's the principal investigator, but he's also listed personally as the lead sponsor on clinicaltrials.gov.
Right.
It's not the hospital sponsoring it. It's not a tech startup. It's literally his name.
Which is huge, because in clinical research, assuming the role of sponsor means accepting personal, regulatory, legal, and ethical liability for the trial's conduct.
Wow.
Yeah, you are not operating behind a corporate veil. It is a massive statement of conviction. He believes deeply in the structural integrity of the firewall he designed.
He's putting his name on the line for it.
He really is. This raises an important question, though, about statutory language, because that firewall introduces a concept that lawmakers desperately need to understand.
The newsletter author points this out, actually.
Yeah.
When legislators draft bills about AI in pediatric settings, they almost universally picture a kid holding an iPad, talking to a cartoon character.
Right. They assume direct interaction.
Always.
But DAPHNE demonstrates that regulatory language needs to evolve.
Yeah.
We have to clearly distinguish between two things.
Okay, what are they?
The addressable user, which in this case is the adult caregiver interacting with the software.
Right.
And the served population, the pediatric patient whose health outcomes are actually being optimized.
Oh, I see. So if a state writes a clumsy law trying to protect kids from AI, they might accidentally ban tools like DAPHNE.
Exactly.
They completely misunderstand that the tool is actually empowering the parents to protect the kids.
Right. The distinction between addressable user and served population, it is a crucial regulatory insight. It allows the healthcare system to utilize the data processing power of these models without compromising the safety of the most vulnerable patients.
Okay, we have covered a lot of ground today.
I really have.
We have a Boston hospital using empathetic avatars to track cancer symptoms. We have a Colorado attorney general forcing developers to code against emotional dependence.
Mm-hmm.
And an Ohio researcher building a pediatric bot that only talks to adults.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. So for the listener trying to process all of this, I mean, maybe you aren't writing state legislation or running clinical trials.
Probably not.
How do you apply this framework to the software you interact with every day?
Well, the application is actually incredibly direct for everyday life. Whether you are vetting a new software vendor for your business, or you're evaluating a tool your child wants to download, or even just navigating a new portal launched by your healthcare provider,
Okay.
you must actively look for the handoff point.
Where does the machine stop?
That is the defining question. If you are looking at a consumer health app and its interface blurs a line between algorithmic sorting and actual clinical advice, like if it doesn't clearly delineate where the software ends and the human professional begins, it is structurally unsafe.
That's a great rule of thumb.
Right. And if your teenager is using a companion app that promises unconditional support, but there's no transparent, hard-coded mechanism for escalating crises to human authorities.
Then it's missing the core architecture of restraint.
Exactly. The presence of a defined handoff point is the litmus test for whether a system was designed with safety as its foundation or whether safety is just a marketing afterthought.
Find the handoff point. It really cuts right through the marketing hype.
It really does.
But I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, something that connects all three of these incredibly smart systems we just talked about.
Okay, let's hear it.
The Boston ECA, the Colorado regulations, the Ohio pediatric bot, they all rely on one massive unspoken assumption.
Which is?
They all assume that the licensed professional on the receiving end actually has the capacity to catch the baton.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the architecture assumes the presence of an available human.
Exactly. We are spending fortunes and deploying incredible ingenuity to build machines that know exactly when to stop diagnosing, when to stop bonding, and when to trigger an alert.
Right, we're doing all this work.
We're perfecting the handoff point. But what happens if the human system on the other side is broken?
Oh, that's heavy.
Right. What if the oncologist receives perfectly structured data from the Boston avatar, but they're too burned out by alert fatigue to review it?
Yeah, that happens all the time.
Or what if the Colorado chatbot successfully detects self-harm and routes the teenager to a school counselor, but that counselor has a caseload of 600 students and misses the notification?
Or what if DAPH&E uncovers a family's food insecurity, but the clinic social worker is entirely out of resources to offer them?
Exactly.
You are highlighting the ultimate limitation of technological guardrails here.
Yeah.
You can build the perfect digital boundary, but if the human infrastructure it hands off to is chronically under-resourced, the safety nets still fail.
We fixed the machine, we've bounded the AI, but have we just built a highly efficient pipeline routing critical data into a human void?
Wow.
It forces us to realize that AI safety isn't just a coding problem. It's a systemic resourcing problem.
Yes, absolutely.
We can't just mandate that AI hands things over to humans without ensuring those humans have the time and energy to actually do the job.
A brilliantly designed handoff is entirely useless if there's no one there to catch it.
That is a lot to think about. Thank you for joining this deep dive as we explored the architecture of restraint, the crucial importance of the handoff point, and the complex reality of keeping humans in the loop.
Thanks for having me.
Keep questioning the systems you interact with, look for those boundaries, and we will catch you next time as we continue to unpack the ideas shaping our world.